Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Today on the Brian Lehrer Show, who put white flags on the Brooklyn Bridge yesterday? And who are they suggesting should surrender? We'll ask Brooklyn Borough President Eric Adams, who calls it an act of terror. Also, the 24-hour ban on U.S. flights to Tel Aviv is about to expire. We'll see if the FAA renews it and ask where else Americans can't fly to out of safety concerns. And should you take Privada to protect yourself against AIDS? But we begin with the biggest legal threat to the Affordable Care Act since the Supreme Court declared it constitutional a few years ago. Did a small glitch in the wording give opponents an opening to cut the heart out of the system? Let's look at yesterday's competing court rulings and see how Obamacare is working for some of you generally. We'll open the phones in a minute with Sarah Cleff, senior editor at Vox. She covers the Health Reform Act. Hi, Sarah. Welcome back to WNYC.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And the rulings, for people who haven't heard this, were both about one thing, and that's the subsidies that people in many states get for their premium payments, depending on their income. Why is that surfacing as an issue now, so long after the act was passed?
Something that's been winding its way up through the court system since about 2012. This was an issue that was noticed by two legal folks here in Washington, actually one out in Ohio, one here in D.C., noticed that some of the wording in the health care law could be read to suggest that states with healthcare.gov, with the federal exchange, are not eligible to dole out subsidies. So this was something that was noticed in 2012, 2 years after the law passed, and has been working its way up through the court system. And just yesterday, we got rulings from two circuit courts, which are the last step before the Supreme Court.
24 states, including New York and Connecticut, have the state exchanges. You don't have to worry if you're there, people, and on one of those. 36 states, including New Jersey, use the federal exchange, mostly because Republican governors like Chris Christie refused to set up a state exchange, and that's where the issue is. Though maybe we should reassure those folks right off the bat, Sarah, that nothing is going to happen in their Obamacare policies right away, correct?
Yes. Nothing changes for folks getting subsidies. Things will go on as normal as this works its way through the court system.
Until and unless there's an ultimate court ruling against those subsidies, which would probably take at least a year or so. Do you have that wording, the exact passage from the law that the courts are deconstructing and coming to opposite conclusions about?
Section 1401 of the law. For any Obamacare enthusiasts, you can actually go look it up yourself. And what it says in that section is that people who are eligible for subsidies or eligible for financial help, they have to be enrolled through an exchange established under this other section, 1311, for those who are keeping track. 1311 only talks about state exchanges. It doesn't talk about healthcare.gov, and that's where this argument stems from, that the federal government and that Congress only intended subsidies to go to states that have state-run exchanges.
Now, listeners, let's use the opportunity of this Affordable Care Act legal dispute being in the news to check in with you generally on how your Obamacare policy is working for you. If you got a policy on any Obamacare exchange, state or federal, how's it working out so far? 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. You know, we took a lot of calls on this when the window was open for buying the policies and there were all those computer problems and you were all weighing your coverage choices and figuring out your subsidies. Let's follow up now as we invite your reports on how the policy is working out so far. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Have you been surprised, pleasantly or unpleasantly, at your choice of doctors in your plan, at the services that have turned out to be covered or not covered under the level of policy that you chose, at the copays or deductibles you thought you were signing up for, at how you get treated having this kind of private insurance, and it is private insurance, as opposed to some other kind, or any other experience with your Obamacare policy now that you're using it to actually pay for health care? 212-433-WNYC. Let's crowdsource the reporting on how Obamacare is actually working out so far for people getting those policies. 212-433-9692. As we continue on the new legal dispute with Sarah Cleff, senior editor at Vox. How could two different courts, Sarah, come to the opposite conclusion about what was on paper, plain as day, in the same subsections of the same law?
It really was kind of a crazy day. It's very rare. I don't know when it's happened before that two circuit courts have literally issued conflicting opinions on the exact same day within hours of each other. And it really comes down to whether the courts thought this language was ambiguous or not. The D.C. Circuit Court, the one that ruled that the language was not ambiguous, that it definitely did not allow for federal subsidies, essentially said, we looked at the law. This is how we read it. There's no ambiguity. The Fourth Circuit, which said, no, the subsidy should continue in the federal exchanges. They said, you know, it looks a little bit ambiguous, and in the case of ambiguity, we defer to the executive branch to interpret law, and we're going to trust their interpretation that says that, yes, the subsidies are meant to go to the federal exchange. So it really comes down to this issue of ambiguity and whether or not courts see it there, and you see two very different opinions coming out on that.
Do politics come into play here? Whether or not we accuse the judges involved of playing politics consciously, did they tend to be appointed by Democrats, appointed by Republicans in the two instances, and so tend to have, you know, either a skeptical eye on anything Obama might do or a different view of the Constitution in terms of how to interpret ambiguity or anything like that?
The panel that did rule against the Affordable Care Act in this case, the D.C. court, did have two Republican appointees on it. And the White House has already said they're going to request en banc review, which means that it goes to all the justices. You sit on that circuit court. And there's generally an expectation, the circuit court, when you look at it as a whole.
Because it was a mini panel on the circuit. It was three judges, right? And so this was a 2-1 ruling. Mm-hmm. Out of a sample of 3 out of a total of 9, who struck down Obamacare, basically.
Yeah, so the White House has already asked to be reviewed by all 9 justices. The expectation is if they are granted that full review, that the ruling will probably come out in the administration's favor, that when you look at that circuit court as a whole, it tends to lean mm-hmm. more liberal. So you might not actually end up with conflicting rulings. You could end up with the Fourth Circuit, which ruled in the administration's favor, and the D.C. Circuit, if they do review it, actually coming to the same conclusion in favor of the health care law.
Was it a coincidence that these two rulings on the same thing with opposite conclusions happened on the same day?
Total coincidence.
Really?
Totally crazy for reporters covering it. You know, we were just getting underway covering the D.C. decision, and all of a sudden we get news that the Fourth Circuit has ruled. A clerk there has said that it was totally coincidence. They were planning to put theirs out the same day, but it was unexpected that we would get two rulings on courts that have been waiting for months to rule, literally the same day within hours of each other.
This wasn't the second court saying, wait, look what they just did. Quick, let's hustle up a ruling to nullify that.
It was a 44-page ruling, so if they were able to pull that together in 2 hours, that's quite impressive on its own.
Yeah, I guess judges don't tend to work that way. Is there any legislative history here? In other words, things like floor debate or where the administration or members of Congress might have made clear on the record what their intent was, or committee meetings, minutes from mm-hmm. when they were actually writing the language, anything like that that would answer the question objectively one way or the other?
There is a little bit of that, but the frustrating thing, so I actually spent yesterday talking to congressional staffers who worked on writing the health care law, and they unanimously, both Republican and Democrat, said our intent was for everybody to get subsidies. That was definitely what we planned. There was never a debate. But the thing about never having a debate is you don't actually have a lot of legislative record on this. People just who I talked to, the congressional staff who wrote this law, said we weren't actively talking about it, so there's not much of a record on this. There are a few documents, and if you look at my story on Vox.com today, you can see those cited, where they do seem to suggest to lay down a record that subsidies were intended for everyone. But the legislative record here isn't super strong, and you know, most we can do is go back to the people who worked on the law and ask them.
And who are they? Do we know who actually wrote the language? I mean, human beings do write these things. Can we go to the source? Do you have a name?
You know, if you look at the folks who I interviewed, it's mostly staff who work on the Senate Finance Committee and the Senate Help Committee are the people who are working on writing this law, like literally putting together the provisions of it. It's no one, you know, I haven't figured out if there's one person who wrote this particular section, but there is a group of congressional staff who were on the Hill in 2009 and 2010 who were drafting this legal language, and they all told me when I interviewed them yesterday that they intended for everyone to have subsidies, and it was never a matter of policy debate on the Hill when this was being debated.
So there are people, and they are saying that, and we'll see if the court takes into account journalistic history when there's no legislative history. But listeners, 212-433-WNYC for Sarah Cliff from Vox, who reports on the Affordable Care Act, 212-433-9692. How's your Obamacare working out? KB in Newark, you're on WNYC. This would affect you, wouldn't it, KB?
Yes, it would directly. I'm in New Jersey, and I didn't have health care for 10 years. And then I went through Obamacare, and seeing the prices and stuff without my subsidy, I would have to go a couple more years without it, because right now I'm working for myself, and the prices out there are just absolutely ridiculous. And like a different aspect to it is I fully believe there will be a backlash if, you know, there's one thing to stop it before it's implemented, but once it's already implemented and a whole lot of people are happy with it, to have it removed is going to be real bad, especially finding out that the two judges who voted for it were Republican judges. So it's one of those situations where you don't want to get mad because of the law, but at the same time you're taking away something that you done already gave.
Yeah, that's really interesting. KB, good luck. And so he brings up, Sarah, both the personal point and ties it into what I think is a really relevant political point. He lives in New Jersey and gets the subsidies on the federal exchange since New Jersey doesn't participate as a state. So he's exactly one of the people who would lose his subsidy if this were to be overturned by the Supreme Court. And his political point is, I think, something that the Republicans have argued all along, or the conservative intellectuals, that it's very hard to take away a benefit from the public that's already been given. And so if they started to withdraw these subsidies and all of a sudden there was, you know, a whole line of people exactly like KB saying, well, gosh, I had health insurance for the first time in 10 years, and now you're making it unaffordable for me again. Thanks a lot. You know, I don't know. Do we live in such a polarized congressional election environment that this wouldn't come back to bite any elected officials?
It's hard to know how this would play out politically. You know, you could see people blaming, if people don't like the healthcare law already, instead of blaming their local representatives, they might blame Obama. They might blame the healthcare law, saying, look at this screwed up healthcare law. It's probably raising my premiums. But it would definitely, you know, to your caller's point, there would be a very big financial impact for Obamacare's enrollees. There's one report that a consulting firm called Avalier put out recently finding that if these subsidies go away, people in healthcare.gov states would see an average of a 76% increase in their premiums. So there'd definitely be a lot of unhappy Obamacare shoppers in that case.
Well, there's no Obamacare without the subsidies, is there? Because then instead of these exchanges, which have these plans, which have to have certain levels of benefits to match certain projected price points so that it is affordable and the subsidies are affordable by the taxpayers. There's no Obamacare without that system, is there? Then it's just private insurance companies selling private insurance without any subsidy system, which is what we had before Obamacare.
Well, it's actually even more screwed up than that, I would argue, because there will still be an individual mandate that everybody has to have coverage. So you have this really even worse, arguably worse situation than before, where you're forcing people to buy coverage but aren't giving them the tools to make that coverage affordable.
Exactly.
This has been an argument that the White House has made in its briefs that, of course, we didn't expect for subsidies not to happen in federal states. You can't make this law work, so why would we draft a law that left out states without subsidies?
Andre in Brooklyn has a subsidy and income question, I think. Hi, Andre. You're on WNYC.
Good morning. I joined Obamacare in December and have given my income level at a false level since I'm self-employed, and I just guesstimated it. And after I did my taxes in April 15th, I figured out that I earned much less than I actually stated. So I called Obamacare in New York and tried to correct it. And they said, well, send us some information, send us your tax return, send us your bank account statements, your receipts, which I did. And maybe 2 weeks later, they came back to me and said, your income level is over $40,000, which actually my actual tax returns showed it for 13.5. So I resubmitted the paperwork again. I called them again, spoke with them several times on the phone. They came back to me and said, your income level is at $17,000. So I resubmitted my paperwork again, same paperwork as always. Then they came back to me and told me that my income level is at $1,800.
What was that last number?
The last number is
$1,800
per year.
Oh, God. So it's a big mess. They can't decide whether you make $40,000 or $1,000.
Pretty much so. They can't read the paperwork.
How did it wind out? Wind up? Did
you? I just left it there.
Yeah.
I mean, with the $13,500 that I'm making, I already qualify for.
And you got the subsidy based on your report of $13,000?
Well, no, I've got the subsidy based on my $1,800. But it's still the same subsidy as for the same
$18,000. So Andre, thank you very much. Sarah, I wonder if this raises an issue of how the subsidies are actually calculated and how the IRS, I guess it's the IRS, verifies how much of a subsidy you're entitled to based on your income because it's self-reported.
It's definitely tricky, and I think it's going to make tax season even more of a headache for people who have gotten subsidies. And, you know, just like Andre mentions, a lot of people estimated what they were going to earn. Those numbers will eventually be reconciled during the next tax filing season with what folks actually did earn. If they used too much of a subsidy because they underestimated their income, they might have to pay money back to the government.
Right.
If they earn less than they thought they would, they might get a refund. But
and that really, that's his story, at least his claim. Mm-hmm. So he would be entitled to a refund that is an additional subsidy under Obamacare than he started paying at the beginning or started receiving at the beginning of the policy year if his 1040 then shows that he made less income than he estimated.
Yes, it's possible that he could get back some of that subsidy as a tax refund, the
right.
subsidy that he would have been eligible to use to buy insurance.
It would be part of his tax refund. I've heard the conservative argument on why they would have inserted this clause into the law that only made the state exchanges eligible for the subsidies is that the law was written to apply pressure to the states to set up their own. Like, if you don't participate here, your people won't get the discounts. Does anyone believe that argument? Because I heard someone say that on television the other day. Does anyone believe that argument, or is that just revisionism designed to help destroy Obamacare?
So this is an argument. It shows up in the court case. I would go back to the congressional staff I talked to yesterday who said, no, it was not meant to be a carrot to get states into participating. We didn't intend subsidies to work that way. So it is an argument that's been made in front of the court. It's been used. But when you talk to the people who actually wrote the law, they really say from the very start of the ACA debate, there was never any discussion of using the subsidies as a carrot. They were always thought to be a thing that would happen in every state.
Bob in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Brian. Yeah, I'd like to tell you about my experience with the Affordable Health Care Act. But let me just say, if you're in a very low-income situation, the exchange puts you on Medicaid. It's not an issue anymore. Now, I had my own insurance I was paying for. It was no longer affordable. So I got the health insurance through the New York State Exchange. I get the subsidy, so I pay 25%. In that sense, it's working out for me very well. Otherwise, I would have to go without any insurance. Now, also, I'm a little bit annoyed because I was told by the insurance company that under the Affordable Health Care Act, dental care is covered. It's the law. They must provide dental coverage. Then I went to the dentist. I found out I do not have dental coverage. And it even said on my membership card, dental coverage prime. But I cannot get dental insurance through the exchange until November. So I wish they would move up the enrollment, for at least for the dental insurance.
That's interesting. Bob, is dental covered, Sarah, under all Obamacare policies, some Obamacare policies? Do you know?
It generally is not. So one of the required benefits is pediatric dental. So they do have to offer dental for kids, but adult dental is not a required benefit under the healthcare law. Typically, you'd need to buy a supplementary plan. And as you mentioned, open enrollment for those plans, unfortunately, does not start until November 15th. So right now, there really isn't a market in Obamacare for those dental plans.
Amanda in Greenwich, you're on WNYC. Hi, Amanda.
Hi, Brian. It's a pleasure to be on your show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm talking with me. Just to one of your earlier points, if there's no subsidy, there's no Affordable Care Act. We're a family of four, middle class family of four, and we're paying about $1,000 a month. So $12,000 a year for a private policy that we purchased, through ConnecticutCT.gov. We got a subsidy.
That is the Obamacare state exchange in Connecticut, correct?
Right, right.
Okay.
So we did get a subsidy for the policy, but it's an Anthem policy. Anthem gets the subsidy, basically, and it's a $6,000 deductible. There's no dental. There's no eye vision. And I feel like, the private companies are totally unaffected. Like, they don't have to play fair. And they can, if you submit a claim, for instance, for an out-of-network service, they'll adjust the amount that they accept. They make, these allowable amounts. You really have a hard time meeting your deductible. So, all this work that Obama has done and that Congress has done, I feel like the private insurance companies, they're not accountable somehow. They're not, playing fair. They're just taking the subsidy. And, it doesn't help us a whole lot.
Amanda, stay there for a second. Sarah Cliff, are you hearing many stories like this?
I definitely hear some people talking about frustration with the products they bought and kind of questioning whether it was worth the money that they're spending given, a large deductible or something like that. Generally, the Commonwealth Fund, a big healthcare nonprofit, they put out a survey finding that generally people were pretty happy with their coverage, that they said they were satisfied or very satisfied. But, there's definitely challenges to be worked out, and I think there are some people who are frustrated with the products that they bought.
Amanda, well, do you get a $12,000 a year is a big chunk of change for a family of four, and that's the kind of number that we were hearing that people have been paying and felt so burdened by on the private market before Obamacare. I guess it could be even more in many cases. But what's your subsidy? Do you know it? Do you get one?
I don't know it offhand. I don't really know it offhand, but a couple $100.
Per month.
And our only alternative was, Connecticut Husky, which is sort of, I think, a state Medicaid for the kids. But our doctors wouldn't take that. So that wasn't an option, really. And I just am curious if the Affordable Care Act sets certain restrictions for how the private, what kind of policies the insurance companies make.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Sarah Cliff?
Sure. Yeah, they definitely do, that insurers are required to cover this set of 10 essential benefits. That's one of the really big requirements, the idea being to get everything that people, at least the basics, covered in those plans. And then in terms of the level of coverage, there are, as someone who shopped on it, you probably experienced there's bronze, silver, and gold level plans, which have to cover.
And then I guess to the kind of difficulty that she's having, welcome to the world of private insurance, where your co-pays and your deductibles and your various streams of out-of-pocket expenses and your deductible for in-network and your deductible for out-of-network and a co-pay on top of that, but not when you go to this kind of doctor or for this kind of checkup. It's really complicated, and it's a part-time job just to manage that if you have a family who uses medical care.
Definitely. And I think this is one criticism from the left of the healthcare law, that it doesn't provide enough financial protection, that it lets the deductibles be too big, that people could still go into medical bankruptcy given how large deductibles could be under the healthcare law.
So to wrap this up and get back to the legal question of whether these subsidies might be struck down entirely by the courts for people who are on the federal exchange, here is White House spokesman Josh Earnest at a briefing in response to these lower court rulings yesterday.
You don't need a fancy legal degree to understand that Congress intended for every eligible American to have access to tax credits that would lower their health care costs regardless of whether it was state officials or federal officials who were running the marketplace.
So what happens now? Do a certain nine justices with fancy legal degrees swoop in and say, okay, competing federal court rulings on something this important, this is a job for the Supremes. We'll settle this, and right away.
So we're not quite sure what happens next. There's this request for en banc review in the D.C. Circuit. We have to see whether that is granted, and if it is granted, what they do rule. Like I said earlier, it's possible they could rule the same thing as the Fourth Circuit did, and then we wouldn't have a circuit split. And either way, it's up to the Supreme Court whether or not they want to accept this case. The Supreme Court could, even if there's an appeal to them to take it, say, no, we don't think it's a thing we're going to weigh in on. So it's definitely probably, I'd say, about a year or so till we'll have full resolution on this. But as you mentioned, I think it's important for everyone to know nothing changes with the subsidies people have in between now and then.
You keep getting your subsidies even if you're in a state that would be affected by overturning them while this makes its way through the courts and presumably at least till like next June or next spring anyway, before the Supreme Court at the earliest could come out with a ruling on this. And the en banc, that is, if the all nine judges on that lower court were to look at the ruling that the three judges made and decide to overrule it, how quickly would that take place? Because that could end the dispute and the subsidies would then just remain in place.
So they have, the White House has 45 days to file their, they've said they're going to file the request, but they have 45 days to actually file it. That's the very first step. So even we're looking at, you know, into the fall, early next year before we have resolution from the D.C. Circuit.
Thank you very much, Sarah Cliff.
Thank you.
Who covers the Affordable Care Act for the website Vox. Thanks a lot. Brian Lehrer and WNYC. Coming up next, the 24-hour ban on U.S. flights to Tel Aviv is about to expire. We'll see if the FAA renews it, and we'll ask where else Americans can't fly to out of safety concerns. Stay with us.